Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm welcomed by a good friend and new co-host to the show, Jay Villar. Hey, Jay, how you doing?
Hey, Aaron. Good to be on the show.
Well, it is a pleasure for you, for me, for all of us. We have a wonderful conversation today. Jay, let's talk a little bit about your background, and then we'll start with that conversation.
Great. Let's do it.
All right. Let's do it. Well, first of all, Jay, welcome up to the great Northeast, moving up from Washington, D.C. recently.
It is good to be here. It's a little cold, but I mentally prepare myself for that transition. So got some fleece, got some big coats, got some boots.
Some down.
Yeah.
It's a state of mind.
You know, cold therapy is in these days.
That's
so
right.
I'm like very much into it. Yeah.
Cool. Jay Villar is the founder and practitioner at Nourish, which is a bespoke consulting company with a mission to educate, teach, and train people on the benefits of using food to heal your body and optimize your health. Jay has been at the forefront of using optimal health techniques, biohacking his nutrition, and to achieve remarkable results in his career. He attributes his success to the principles he learned by studying health, nutrition, and business principles on increasing your energy, sharpening your mind, and being a more productive human being. Jay now spends his time teaching people how to use food to heal their body, speaks to businesses on how to optimize focus and productivity using nutritional and behavioral science. Jay is also a host of his own podcast. You have Seasoned Vet here, which you listen to your mother, which you co-host to. It's a series you co-host with your mother, Rosalie.
Correct.
All right. Good man. That's good stuff right there. And additionally, you just completed a fellowship at the Rodale Institute.
That's correct. Yeah. So most recently, I completed my education at the Rodale Institute, which is a organic research farm. So your parents may have received the magazine called Organic Gardening, and Rodale Publishing actually published that magazine. And J.I. Rodale, many, many years ago, discovered that there was a link between how the health of our soil impacts the health of the plants, impacts the health of the person. So he used his publishing investment into starting this organic research farm. And for the past 30 plus years, it has now been something the leading researchers on why organic is greater than conventional in organic practices and organic agriculture practices, as well as now looking into the conversation of regenerative agriculture and how actually putting more nutrients back into the soil and bringing those plant matter up helps us as not only a population, but also the environment. So as a nutritional therapist, I was very interested in understanding not just the principles of what to do with the food to heal the body once it's out of the ground, but also how to actually put there in the first place. So I really took this year to kind of do a 360 view look of what that ecosystem entails, why is it so important, and how to then expand that conversation into others who are also interested in the field of regenerative agriculture, as well as those in the conversation of food as medicine.
A systems thinking approach to this whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating when you actually sort of think about not only kind of how and where we get our food, but how our food is grown. I mean, the links doesn't take, you know, too hard to think about how those are all connected. And then we start paying attention to our own health when we realize things like boron is a nutrient that is very much sort of missing in our bodies. And boron comes from the soil, you know, so if it's not in the soil, plants like beets aren't picking them up. And if we're not eating those beets, then we're not getting it as well. So when we start to then just get that curtain removed and look at where, as your show says, sourcing matters, it really does make a huge difference to look at that. And then hopefully those big thinkers out there are actually helping us sort of solve that for not only our generation, but the generations that follow.
Hmm. Well, it's exciting for me to hear a nutritionist with your background that's focusing on sourcing. And as you said, sourcing does matter. Maybe it's good for a podcast. It is, yes. So, Jay, let's jump into the conversation. And I actually, by the way, I have been down to Kutztown, Pennsylvania. That's a great site that they have down there. It's an excellent research center. I'm sure it was a wonderful experience.
It was a great experience. The farm is lovely. They open up the institute for visitors. So if anyone ever wants to go down just to give themselves a guided tour or sign up for any of their trainings and education, it's a phenomenal resource for folks that want to learn more about organic, regenerative agriculture, and health.
So on December 5th, Time Magazine released an article talking about eggs. And they titled this, "Whether you eat them every day or just occasionally, there's plenty to learn about how to incorporate eggs into a healthy diet." And the article focused on the dietary and dietitian's perspective, which all weighed in on what you need to know about your eggs. Such leading questions throughout the article talked about, are eggs healthy? Should I eat egg yolks? How about egg whites? Will eggs raise my cholesterol? And how do I prepare them in the most healthy way? The article states that nutritional experts now agree that the protein and vitamins in eggs make them a very healthy option. We have Brigitte Zieltlin, who said, "I would say eggs are very healthy, with 13 essential vitamins and minerals, plus they're a good source of high protein. They're what our body needs to build and maintain strong, healthy muscles. And one egg has 6 grams of protein. One large egg has only 72 calories, as they state, providing a lot of nutrition in a small caloric package. Sounds like a bunch of talking points in some ways in this article, to be honest, as we read through this. But I gotta ask, and I keep reading this and questioning, and I think a lot of our listeners will be doing the same, is why are those same eggs now healthy for me as compared to 5 years ago when the science said that they weren't?
And yeah.
This leads to some questions of miscommunication, misunderstanding, and then how do we just jump ship and go completely in a different direction?
Yeah, so if you ask the average person on the street whether they think eggs are healthy, the majority of them will say that maybe they're unhealthy because eggs raise your cholesterol, right? And then if you start to then ask them, well, what does cholesterol do? They says, well, elevated cholesterol will give you a heart attack. And what they're referring to, right, is the heart health hypothesis that leads to elevated cholesterol causing heart disease, i.e. then a heart attack. And that's just, first off, what it is, Aaron. It's a heart health hypothesis that actually was never have been proven. Mm. And most people don't understand what cholesterol actually is and what it does for the body. So cholesterol is the mother of all hormones. Like, our bodies need cholesterol. And as we age, we actually need more cholesterol. So as we age, having high cholesterol isn't necessarily a bad thing. So when you start to break down food into single nutrients, right, eggs equal cholesterol, high cholesterol equals bad, you then start to then associate eggs meaning that they're bad, and they're not. Eggs are actually a whole food, and what actually matters is how that egg actually been prepared. Has that egg come from a chicken that is vegetarian fed, that is scratching grass, that is, you know, part of the ecosystem of the land that is around it? Or has that egg come from a hatchery that the chicken never sees sunlight, and that's where those eggs are coming from? And there's a starch difference between those two different types of eggs. So if you're actually looking for an egg that's actually going to provide the nutrients that our bodies need in a very healthy, nutrient-dense way, then what we're looking for are the eggs that have come from the hens, that have scratched the ground, that have eaten the bugs, that come from a natural diet. And you are paying more because it's the value of there is there. Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for, you know, just to have eggs, and eggs aren't necessarily part of your diet, and all you have access to are sort of whole eggs, then that's another way to approach your health as well. But if you're looking for just the protein in eggs, where you're thinking about the egg whites, where you kind of imagine that bodybuilders are just trying to get the protein out of eggs, sort of eggs whites, and it comes from like the box of eggs. Those are some of the most like highly processed eggs that you can find, and the nutrients are coming out of the yolk. Mm-hmm. So you want the yolk no matter where it is and where it's coming from. The more that you can get that egg from a chicken that has lived the life of being on the ground and being part of nature, that's where you're going to get the majority of your nutrients. So an egg is not an egg, it's not an egg. And looking for eggs that have come from chickens that are part of nature are going to be your best bet.
Fascinating. Well, I think that's a great explanation of this, because what I did find interesting in the article, and to your point, is that there was barely mention of those sourcing practices of raising eggs. They considered an egg to be an egg, to be an egg, no differentiation of whether it was organic, cage-free, free-range, pastured, grain-fed, bug-fed, local farms, NAE, whatever the iteration of differentiation may be, they basically treated it as almost marketing fluff. There was not really a determination of this did affect the overall impact of if this egg is healthy or not. So, I think it's maybe a state of the industry, and maybe where you're very progressive in this, to look at it as it's a systems thinking rather than a reductionist approach of breaking it down to individual line items of what nutrient is where. Well,
and you can do a very easy experiment. Like if you go to the grocery store and you buy, an industrialized egg, let's say you go to the farmer's market and you buy an egg that farmer has raised him or herself, and literally take two plates, crack a industrial egg on plate one and farmer's market egg on plate two, and you will see a starch difference between the color and the density and the volume of yolk that's there. Mm. And just by your own naked eye, you're saying, which one do I think actually is more nutrient dense? And I would probably say that the one bought at the farmer's market is going to be your best bet.
Mm. Lots of orange in that beta carotene, right?
That's so it.
Yeah. Well, this cues it up for our conversation today, which we're lucky enough to welcome a guest who has sourced a lot of animal protein and maybe an egg or two in her career. An industry expert and leader who has been directly responsible for coaxing large-scale American production and broad distribution to become more sustainable, more responsible, and more appreciative to market trends of a modern consumer. Today, we welcome Sylvia Wolf. Hey, Sylvia, how you doing?
I'm great. Thanks, Aaron.
Welcome, Sylvia.
And thanks, Jay.
Yep.
Nice to hear that conversation.
Yeah, it's funny because we all sit there, right? And even us at this table will go through and you see those nine iterations of different egg types and why there's price differentiation, and we're confused. So if we're confused, I would say the masses are confused. Well, what an opportunity for us to learn more. Sylvia, let me do this if I could. Let me read a bit about your background and then we'll jump into the questions. So during her career, Sylvia Wolf has led development and execution of customer-centric strategies that created innovation and differentiation of business she managed. Her most recent and now past role as president of Stockyard, senior vice president of merchandising, and president of manufacturing division of U.S. Foods, which is a $23 billion broadline food service distribution, is the second largest food service distributor in the U.S., in fact. But you've recently moved on from that role.
I have.
Yeah, congratulations. You are now taking, as of January, a role as CEO of Aqua Bounty.
I am. It's a very exciting opportunity and allows me to really pursue my passion for sustainability and innovation.
It's interesting. I was reading more of your background. So you were responsible for the $10 billion protein and produce categories within U.S. food, which incorporated seafood. And from my understanding, that from some of the past work and some of the boards you've sat on, seafood has been an area of great interest for you. So why did you decide Aqua Bounty was the right space? And what's so unique about the technology and innovation that they're offering to the marketplace?
Well, it starts with understanding that we're going to need to feed the world, and we need to do it in a sustainable manner in terms of both the environment as well as impact on people and the economy. And so because that's been a passion of mine, the work that I did at U.S. Foods as we really built out our sustainability platform started with seafood, because because it is probably one of the most complex areas and subject to lots of sustainability concerns, whether it's overfishing, whether it's labor, whether it is the impact on the environment. And so we went through about a two-year process to really think through what that was going to look like for U.S. foods, because seafood is about a $2 billion category within that $10 billion of protein purchases that they did. And so what that led me to was having conversations with all of our different suppliers and looking at the methodologies that they were using to bring seafood to market. And seafood is a wonderful source of protein, and I think the more that we can increase our seafood consumption, the better it is for the body, for the planet, for the environment. So it really did become a passion of mine.
With your work in elevating the production standards while at U.S. Food, did you become enlightened in the procedures? And seafood might be a good example of this because it's such a global commodity distribution channel. Did you become enlightened to the perspectives of this holistic aspect of sourcing? And how did you manage that within a large organization that does such broad line distribution? Because I think we and some of our listeners might get a little caught up in the regenerative models, and we know that that's the aspirational standards, but there's another entire supply chain that is that supports 85-90% of throughput within wholesale. How have you been able to coax that environment along, and have you seen specific examples within fisheries?
I think that's a really good point in that as a broadline distributor, we needed to be able to provide our customers the choices that aligned with their business needs as well as potentially some of their personal aspirations or values. And so that requires us to think through not only the assortment that we're bringing to market, but the supply chain that supports that. And I think seafood and produce are probably two of the best examples of how do we really ensure that we are bringing value-based choices, economic-based choices to that customer base? Because some of our customers, quite frankly, sustainability and the impact on the environment would not be their highest priority. It's their ability to run a business. And I think most people would recognize that the restaurant industry is a very tough industry and that a lot of them fail. And that's because of the economics involved. So we wanted to make sure that we were focused on having, using our purchasing power to create a more sustainable approach to the supply chain while still continuing to deliver great value to those customers. And when we think about seafood, it was, in fact, we put in inspection-based sourcing overseas, so that we could begin to think through what are those land-based aquaculture systems and how do we manage that appropriately so that, one, the product is exactly what we think it is and that it hasn't been treated either with chemicals or antibiotics, and that those things are called out. And then the second is, what for produce, what's the impact on the soil? Are we aligning ourselves with growers that understand good agricultural practice? Because the more that we can invest in those farmers, the more value we brought to our customers. So that was the decision criteria that we looked at, is we needed to bring economic value as well as a positive impact and a sustainably positive impact on the environment.
You know, Sylvia, when I sort of hear conversations like this, you know, my perspective is always trying to look at the end consumer with the lens of nutritional health. And when I talk to like my clients and I do my speaks, my talks and my lectures and my workshops, you know, in talking about seafood in particular, you know, I always talk about how, you know, wild caught seafood, like, you know, salmon, and, you know, just for that example, is going to be more beneficial than, you know, farm-raised salmon that have been fed corn. And you can, you know, see the color difference between, you know, what that pink looks like versus what, you know, a true pink looks like if it's sort of wild caught. And I can understand, sort of get, you know, the economics of it if you're trying to sell, you know, to restaurants that are trying to, you know, have as much control over their inventory costs as they possibly can. So how do you kind of like look at those end results? Where is, do you see a demand more for end products that are more wild caught versus farm raised?
Actually, what I would say is that farm-based is seeing the increasing demand. And again, you have to think about the impact on the environment. One of the challenges with wild-caught are the quotas and making ensuring that we aren't depleting, you know, supply of wild-caught fish, any species, because of overfishing. And you know, we went through that several years ago. Where we actually had to stop fishing certain varieties because we were overfishing. And I don't know that I necessarily agree that farm salmon or farm fish couldn't have the same nutritional profile as a wild caught, because having worked for one of the the largest protein company in the world, I know the time and effort that goes into creating the right feed profiles for poultry, beef, and pork, and it's the same for seafood. Those are veterinarians, animal nutritionists, looking at what are they feeding those animals to ensure that they have the right nutritional profile, you know, when they're brought to harvest. So a lot of it is ensuring that the feed is, in fact, creating the right nutritional profile.
How, when dealing, whether it's seafood or any of the proteins you're discussing, you know, some estimates put that 60% of seafood is fraudulent. It's actually a different species than what's actually put on the plate. So when you were at U.S. Foods, how did you deal with that type of a supply chain, coming with so many different sourcing partners, so many different distributors of seafood? How did U.S. Foods guarantee that the integrity was there within your supply chain?
So one of the first things that we did was align ourselves with the Sustainable Fisheries Project. And what that organization does is they are collecting data on the producers, you know, and it is a very complicated industry because you have harvesters, you have secondary processing, you have aquaculture, you have, you know, wild caught. And so the SFP invested the time and the resources to track and monitor production from each one of the vendors that we used to ensure that, in fact, we were receiving exactly what was in the that was labeled in the box. And you're absolutely right. In a lot of cases, seafood is mislabeled. It's not the species that you think, or it has been treated, and that chemical treatment is allowing that. Shrimp is a perfect example, to maintain higher levels of water because it's been treated with tripolyphosphate. and we wanted to ensure that we had an outside organization that could verify and validate what our vendors were putting in the box. So that was one of the first things that we did. The other was we were the first distributor to join the Global Seafood Sustainability Initiative, and really understanding how fish were being either harvested or farmed and raised, and implementing best aquacultural practices for farm fish, as well as wild-caught standards for those that were fished in the wild. And so between those two organizations and those certifications, we were ensuring that our customers were getting exactly what was claimed on the label in the box.
You had mentioned that we are in a situation here where farm raising fish is an essential part moving forward. And I think what I've seen for statistics that show that as of 2012, we are now raising 50% of total protein or total fish consumed is actually farm raised. Many of those practices in raising fish are shortcuts. And Jay alluded to this, of some of the misnomers associated to it come down to the short feedstuffs that we use, the shortcuts involved. A three-dimensional feedlot environment will be an equivalent where we're having to stuff and completely use vast amounts of antibiotics. But it seems with your new firm, with Aqua Bounty, you're taking a very modern approach to this. You're looking at genetic engineering of fish to making it so that they do better in these farm-raised environments. Could you give us a bit more detail about what you're up to with Aqua Bounty and that?
I'd love to, and thank you for that question. The reason that I'm joining Aqua Bounty is because the primary opportunity here is to create a land-based recirculating aquaculture system. And what that means is that you have a complete closed loop so that you are, you know, you're purifying the water and all of the waste is being used for fertilizer. And so, and the fish are not exposed to either disease or predators, et cetera, which is the case in many farm-raised environments, hence the need to treat them with antibiotics. So because those land-based recirculating aquaculture systems are highly environmentally friendly, because of that closed-loop approach, the challenge was, how do you do that in an economically viable manner? And so understanding that they wanted to have a much more positive impact on the environment led to bioengineering the salmon so that, in fact, it could grow in half the time and then becomes an economically viable option for that salmon to be raised in a land-based system. And so what they did was they took a gene from a Chinook salmon and they transgenically engineered an Atlantic salmon. And what that gene allowed that Atlantic salmon to do is grow in half the time. And it also has a highly economical feed conversion component to it. So we're able to grow salmon in a land-based recirculating aquaculture system in half the time with the same nutritional profile, no use of antibiotics, no exposure to other predators or dangers like sea lice. And so it really is the future of land-based aquaculture is going to require. So it's very exciting.
You know, Sylvia, I was doing a little bit of research on Aqua Bounty before this interview, and you know, it was reported that they kind of had a little bit of a rough start, right? So the New York Times reported that they, you know, cut their staff from 27 to 12. You know, they raised a couple more $1 million, but it only lasted for a few years, and then it was finally like acquired to the current parent company that is now. You know, so obviously there were some initial challenges that they found to get off the ground. How have they addressed those initial challenges, and what do you see for the future so that, you know, those challenges are in their past?
Well, I think the first is, you're absolutely right. I think the first out of the gate, the first new technology is in fact usually, you know, pioneers get shot, right? So the fact that they would be the first transgenic animal to be brought to market required 20 years of testing with the FDA and with the Canadian regulatory authorities. But what I believe that allows us to do is we have 20 years worth of science that show that this fish is viable, safe for consumption, and the FDA and the Canadian regulatory authorities have agreed with that. And so going through that 20 years of testing is what put the financial challenges on the company. That being said, we would expect, so the FDA has already approved it, and what we're waiting for is the language on the labeling to be approved. And we would expect that to be in the next 30 to 60 days, which allows us then to begin growing that fish in the U.S., just like we are in Canada, and bringing that to market within the next year and a half. So again, it's a lot about the caution, which I believe was justified, in terms of bringing something like a transgenic salmon to market. But it is a food-safe product, and again, allows us to accomplish all of those other environmental and nutritional benefits to bring those to market. And I think the company is definitely viable. We've had quite a bit of interest from a number of investors that believe that this is the future of food production and are willing to invest in the company.
I have a bunch of friends that, and I too, and family members that are fishermen. Mm-hmm. And the Atlantic salmon, where we're out here in the Northeast, is a big deal. We look at this as kind of a seasonal rite of passage. It's a practice. We have certain rivers that these, and same on the West Coast, you know, you're speaking of the Chinook or Alaskan salmon. Some of the concern I've heard associated with aqua bounty or raising these, and I guess this would be a question for you, Sylvia, is how do we guarantee that these transgenesis salmon that you're putting out to market for food product don't introduce themselves or not commingled within natural colonies or natural schools?
Mm-hmm. That's an easy question to answer. Number one, the fish are sterile. Once they produce the eggs, they don't reproduce. That's the first thing. And the second is they are raised in a land-based closed system. So those fish are not ever in any proximity to current Atlantic salmon. That's not how they're going to be raised. And so it's a closed containment system, and unless they grow legs and walk out of the tanks, there's no chance of what you described occurring.
Yeah, that was I think it was last year that it was an East Coast salmon producer that was producing on the West Coast with East Coast fish that were in a not a land-based environment, but the cages became compromised,
right.
And that became a significant issue for environmentalists. So sounds interesting. So by confining them into their own environment, as you said, we're not at that point of evolving fish to actually grow legs yet. So, but we'll keep them in a closed environment, but they produce a healthy quality and manageable supply of good quality food. And salmon, is it behind shrimp as far as the top consumed seafood in the U.S.? I think it's right up there, I know.
It is.
Yeah.
It is.
So it's
right behind shrimp.
Right behind shrimp. And so
growing.
Because we don't do it all here, and a lot of it's not produced in the U.S., correct?
Yeah, no, most of it is produced overseas.
Overseas.
Norway and Chile.
So this is also a story of jobs creation, economic development for impoverished areas, for areas that want to get into innovation economies. You're looking at fisheries and future production as being a regional microcosm here in the States as well.
That's exactly right. If you think about what's happened with some of our agriculture in the center of the country, this gives us the opportunity to do land-based systems, those land-based farms, closer to the retailer, which now we're not flying fish in from Chile or from Norway, which reduces the carbon footprint and creates jobs locally. So it really has a lot of benefits that I don't think we've fully explored at this point in time.
Yes, so like speaking of the future and kind of looking at what the potential opportunity of this is, I can't help but sort of think about, you know, this conversation that people were probably having when they were evolving corn, right? When we were looking at genetically modified our corn, and it was going to be this new way in which we can produce food. It can be added to other foods, and now it's sort of everything. And now there's obviously this movement of non-GMO, and now companies are actually now labeling themselves that they're not putting any genetically modified organisms like in their food processing, and that's now their like marketing point where the consumers are looking for those types of products. How have you sort of envisioned kind of getting ahead of either that conversation so that people aren't looking at Aqua Bounty and the genetically modified fish that you guys are doing as just another version of GMOs?
Yeah, I think that it's definitely going to be a challenge. And I think that most consumers don't really understand genetic modification. We've been doing hybridization and genetic selection for years. But again, when Monsanto came up with Roundup Ready, and they really didn't explain the benefits to the consumer. They went to the farmer, which it was an economic conversation. The opportunity is to reduce the amount of Roundup that's going into the watershed. They never talk about those consumer messages. There's nothing wrong with genetic modification. It's a food. It's definitely a safe food. It's been tested. It has all the properties of, you know, corn that's been hybridized, you know, raised via hybrids. It's just accelerating that genetic transformation. And so I think just like I'll actually use your egg example. 5 years ago, consumers were told, you know, reduce your consumption of eggs because it's going to raise your cholesterol. And now we're finding that eggs are, in fact, an excellent and nutritious source of protein. So I think the science is going to evolve. I think that consumers need to understand that the genetically modified food is safe. I think those companies that have sort of jumped on that bandwagon because of the pressure of the activists are going to have to find a way out because, quite frankly, without scientific intervention, we are not going to be able to feed the world. And I'll give you another example. I'm on the sustainability advisory board for an organization called Two Blades. And what Two Blades is doing is genetic modification of crops like potato, citrus, et cetera, for both pesticide resistance and drought resistance. It's going to allow us to grow crops with smallholder farmers in areas where they were never going to be able to do that previously. And they're using chemicals to try to, fight off some of the challenges that they have, where, in fact, genetic modification can reduce the use of chemicals, create a livelihood for those small farmers, and, in fact, produce crops that are going to allow us to feed the world.
Fascinating stuff, Sylvia. I mean, it really interesting. And, I mean, I think we all come at it from there is a bit of a hardened perspective from the consumer of being felt like they were lied to with genetic engineering, that that it was kind of intertwined within our food systems without their knowledge. A lot of the methodology that we've put for genetic engineering, which we had Kevin Esfeld from MIT Media Lab come on and talk to us and explained, it was basically like playing with Lincoln Logs compared to the technology that we now have for engineering crops and what that can mean. But when the engineering capacity was to make Roundup ready capacity, resilience to other resistance to other features, that so you could use more of that chemicals, I think that's where some of those concerns associated to what is next from Big Food Company. I think thank you for taking the time today to be on the hot seat a bit with us and answering some of those questions, because it sounds like that's something that you and Aqua Bounty have thought a great deal about, have looked at it differently, and sounds like transparency is a bit of what you're going for with this approach to the future of your salmon product.
Absolutely. I think that the consumer should know where and how their food is produced, but I think that we need to do a better job of educating that consumer in terms of the food safety of that product. I watched a panel at South by Southwest last year, and it was, GMO versus non-GMO. And the non-GMO was a lot more about big corporations controlling the food supply because they're the ones that can invest in the R&D and the regulatory process. And I think that the economic concerns are definitely ones that we should care about. But the reality is that there's a ton of testing and regulatory approval. So the food is going to be safe. But again, who's going to control it and who's going to have access to it? And I think small firms like Aqua Bounty that have fought the battle for 20 years, we're going to be the first. And I think that's going to give incentive to other small companies to be able to invest and make sure that we have a viable, nutritious food supply going forward.
It is a direct alignment with our identity politics, but maybe like climate has become, unfortunately. But it's very interesting, and I think no matter what, it's pushing the envelope, and it's making people look differently. And I think we've all come to a consensus here is we are through this discussion, through these conversations. Sylvia, through your presentations at groups like at Choose Food, that event down at Johns Hopkins, You provide information to people that was once not there, that transparency, traceability, and really just knowing so that there is some integrity behind this will go a long way, and we can have different offerings, different selections and criteria that people will be happy with choosing within their food systems. Jay, do you have any final thoughts for today?
Yeah, I think, Sylvia, I really appreciate your, time and expertise in this area, and the way that I sort of just view and sort of frame these conversations is that, there's always going to be, folks that just don't know where their food comes from, and whatever sort of shows up on their plate is whatever shows up on their plate, and they're sort of like okay with it, right? And then there's going to be folks that are really invested in learning and understanding not just kind of what's on their plate, but how that food got there in the first place. And the perspective that I come from with like my background is I always look at, you know, what did sort of like nature teach us to get us in this first place? And what is man doing in our sort of economic world to, you know, change or evolve that? Mm. And my whole thing is like, if folks can know where the food comes from, just having like a backyard garden and growing their food and understanding that whole process will allow them to then understand the bigger picture as far as where and how we're getting, you know, our food. So, mm-hmm. you know, companies that are providing us the access and have created the supply chain so it's easy for us to walk to a grocery store and do that, I think that's not sort of going to go away. But the more that I feel we can educate ourselves as far as where, you know, the soil comes from, to where that plant came from, to how and who prepared it for us and what that is actually doing for our body, mm-hmm. you know, opening up that link and that conversation, you know, just evolves us, I believe, you know, as human beings.
Right. And what your yolks look like in your eggs.
Exactly.
Exactly. Sylvia, where can our listening audience learn more about yourself and Aqua Bounty? Is the website the best place?
That is the best place, aquabounty.com. And our website provides all of the information on the testing, the genetics in our salmon, land-based recirculating aquaculture systems, etc. And so again, I second what Jay said, that I think we need to ensure that consumers, those that care, have access to transparent information. But I also think that it's our responsibility to ensure that we are going to be able to feed the world and think about all the food insecurity that exists today, but in an environmentally and sustainable fashion.
Well, fantastic, Sylvia. We look forward to seeing more great things come from you beginning in January at Aqua Bounty. And I'll just say I can't thank you enough for taking the time today to share this information with us and with our listening audience. I learned a great deal. I know they
sure
will,
did. Yeah.
And Jay is as well. I think it was a very intriguing and engaging conversation. And I'll just say until next time, Sylvia, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Thanks, Sylvia.